This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, cultivating resilience, empowering host resistance, prioritizing primary prevention. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander. I welcome you to another short clip exploring Neijing Now. For this Thanksgiving special short clip, I spoke with Professor Neil Prendergast. He teaches history at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and has a particular interest in turkeys. As our conversation took place over the phone, I'm reminded of the sound of As It Happens from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Dr. Prendergast, welcome to Neijing Now.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about turkeys.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in turkeys, and that makes me an unusual person to most people.
What do you call a turkeyophile?
I think you just said it. I'm interested in the animal in kind of a different way than I think most people who know things about turkeys are interested. So, for example, wildlife biologists know all about what makes good turkey habitat, and they also know quite a bit about how to create that habitat. Turkey farmers know a lot about the correct ratio of feed to give a turkey as it's growing throughout the summer months. All sorts of different people know very particular things about turkeys. And what I'm interested in is having a holistic perspective, including history, when it comes to understanding this very interesting animal.
What's the holistic perspective on turkey?
For me, it's really sort of mapping out how it is that we've created all of these divergent knowledges about turkeys, and to really see that as a long historical process that has everything to do with the creation of the conservation movement in this country, which helped create the field of wildlife biology, has everything to do with the industrialization of agriculture, which has given us agricultural science, and also actually has quite a bit to do with the way those activities are or have been gendered in some important ways.
Gendered? What do you mean by gendered?
If I can kind of tell a little bit of a story here, sort of at the heart of the way I understand the turkey. Once upon a time, say in the early 1800s in this country, it was very common and completely ordinary thing to do for American farm women to cross wild turkeys with domestic turkeys. And so they would do things as simple as going out into the woodlot and probably already being aware of a turkey flock that would frequent the woodlot, finding the turkey eggs, finding the nest, and bringing those eggs back to their sort of barnyard flock and having a domestic turkey sit on those eggs. And then, of course, with the resulting turkeys that come from the eggs, having those be a part of the barnyard flock. And this was viewed as an entirely ordinary thing, crossing the wild and domestic strains.
Do you know why they would do that?
Well, yeah, sure. It makes a lot of sense because it was relatively easy to do. It combined tasks. Going out into the woods was sort of a common thing for farm people to do, whether it was to look for other animals, whether it was to gather plants that were important. It was a sort of common activity to look beyond what we would regard as the strict borders of the farm today, being just the fields, what people are now calling an agroecology, combining the strict farming practices with the ecology of the surrounding area. So it was kind of part of routine, but also the resulting birds by crossing the domestic and wild strains were really good birds to have because they could more or less take care of themselves. It's really interesting to read farm women's diaries of the 19th century and to see the amazing amount of work they had to do every day. So these strong birds could more or less take care of themselves. They could be rounded up in the fall when it was time to eat the birds.
And they would be slightly easier to deal with than the wild turkeys because they still were domesticated and they'd be easier to round up.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they're still going to come around the barnyard, right? Look for some scraps and stuff like that. Absolutely.
Right. I'm impressed these women had time to keep a diary.
Yeah, right. Well, they're very rare, actually. And, you know, there are some really good ones out there, especially from New England. I highly recommend the diary of Martha Ballard, and there's a wonderful book called A Midwife's Tale about her diary that everybody should go read.
Great. She was a midwife as well.
Yes, so you can imagine how busy she was. Not necessarily somebody who wanted to spend every waking hour thinking about turkeys, right?
Right, like you do.
Right. I told you at the outset I was sort of an unusual person. What's surprising to me about all of this is that in the 20th century, and in fact as recently as a couple years ago, it was very common to regard wild turkeys and domestic turkeys as two totally different lines. I was reading in the Los Angeles Times in 2010, I'm always looking out for these little pieces around Thanksgiving to see what our popular understandings of turkeys are. And the LA Times is saying that the wild bird is completely separate from the domestic bird. And I just thought, well, that's absolutely wrong because farm women were forever crossing these lines. I realized the LA Times and popular knowledge does not really take into account the lives of farm women from the 19th century. And I started to think a little bit about why that was. And it has everything to do with the professionalization of our knowledge about nature. I started to look a little bit more deeply into what wildlife biologists were writing in the 20th century. In the 60s, the Wildlife Society put out a very good book on turkeys, but in it they said, look, we have no idea what turkey raising practices have been like historically. I thought, well, my gosh, how do you not know that?
You had already been looking into that.
Right. So I started to kind of try to put this big puzzle together about why is it that we don't know this one very basic thing about turkeys, which is that the wild and domestic are interwoven genetic lines. Like, why don't we know that? And the kind of story I put together has actually everything to do with an amazing population crash in turkeys at the end of the 19th century.
In wild turkeys?
Wild and domestic. The wild turkey population plummeted from perhaps a couple of million in 1800, which was already pretty low. Historical ecologists tell us that there were probably about 10 million when Columbus arrived. And by the early 1800s, we're thinking maybe 2 million wild turkeys in North America. By the turn of the century, we're getting maybe just in the tens of thousands. Overhunting and habitat destruction. You know, nothing new there in terms of population demise for any kind of wild creature.
Okay.
But at the same time, domestic populations were plummeting also. So what had happened is production had kind of increased throughout the 19th century, in particular for Thanksgiving. As your listeners probably know very well, when you get a concentration of animals in any one place, we got disease, so much so that the population of domestic turkeys had climbed to about 11 million in 1890, but then plummeted in 1920 to about 3.5 million.
Wow.
And then the story of restoring these turkeys is the story of how our knowledge about turkeys became split. That's what I find to be really fascinating. We have people in the 20th century who try to resuscitate the domestic turkey in North America. And this is by and large a project of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They think that the turkey is going to be a fairly good moneymaker for farmers who in the early 20th century are not doing very well. The USDA creates a whole body of agricultural scientific knowledge around the domestic turkey. They study it in all sorts of laboratory ways. And to them, they have no interest in what farm women are doing in the 19th century. They have no concern at all for that memory. They're interested in things like antibiotics. They're interested in getting the right feed. They're interested in coming up with very modern shelters for turkeys, that type of stuff.
Right.
And then wildlife biologists are also very concerned about their own very particular type of turkey. They certainly don't want to know anything about how farm women crossed wild and domestic breeds, because what they're trying to do is create a wild turkey that can be hunted. Because wildlife biologists employed by state game and fish commissions realize that they've got to create a product for the public, right? If the public isn't hunting something, then their agency isn't getting funded. And so the project of state game and fish agencies is to create huntable animals, fishable animals.
It feels a little bit ironic that a wildlife biologist is trying to create a product.
Yeah, we don't think of it that way, but that's, I mean, very much what they're doing. Their agencies are funded, by and large, through the sale of hunting permits. Their charge is to create habitat for animals that the public wants and to destroy animals, particularly predators, that the public does not want.
Wow.
This is, you know, very true for the early, mid-20th century. So they wanted a pure wild turkey. And that's by and large what they created, so much so that even though the population of wild turkeys was just in the tens of thousands in the early 20th century, Today, it's about 7 million.
Wow.
As far as wildlife biology goes, it's one of the biggest stories of success.
Is this what you mean by the professionalization of our knowledge, that each profession has their own boundary around what kind of knowledge they're pursuing and it's not integrated with any other discipline?
You said it very well. That's exactly it. So the professionalization of knowledge in this case really relies on understanding wild as absolutely different from domestic.
So why is that important for us to understand now?
Well, I think that we should always be questioning how it is we know what we think we know. And I think it's particularly important for people, especially in the heritage turkey industry. In the late 19th century, farm women who were breeding these turkeys created different strains. What's possible in an animal that reproduces very quickly, like a bird, is that you get genetic changes manifesting themselves very quickly, in particular in color. So all of these different breeds arose in the late 19th century as farm women started to kind of play around a little bit. And they would create things like the red Bourbon turkey, which, as it suggests, has some red coloring to it. There was turkeys like the Narragansett turkey, which had some neat white marks on some of its feathers. There was the white Holland turkey, which is a purely white turkey. And there was the favorite one, the bronze turkey, which had green and blues and purples in it, depending on how the light hit the feathers. And that was the most popular turkey. Today, those breeds are now known as heritage breeds, and all of them were continually interwoven with the wild turkey. And I would encourage people who are interested in buying a heritage turkey or maybe even thinking about raising heritage turkeys to think about not so much the animal as this isolated thing, but to think about it as embedded in a whole social system of farming from the 19th century. Then I think we just simply know more about how past humans have engaged the natural world and understood it in entirely different ways.
Right, beautiful. Now, today, if you go out to buy a heritage turkey, that turkey is purely a domestic turkey.
That's pretty safe to say, although there might be some farmers doing that, right? I don't know.
If one was to want to honor this history and be cognizant of it this Thursday, how would one incorporate this knowledge into the Thanksgiving feast?
The Thanksgiving feast presents this opportunity to think about where food comes from. Maybe it would be interesting to get into what landscapes the food comes from, and not being just concerned with about very important matters like organics, but to think a little bit about how the food comes from not just a particular place in sense of a dot on the map, but how are crops grown in tandem with non-crops? How does the farm integrate domestic strains of whatever with wild plants? It doesn't have to be just turkeys. What sort of landscape does our food come from? And not just in terms of, you know, is it organic, but is it a landscape that actually has a place for what we might call the wild? A good example of this is shade-grown coffee. The whole point of shade-grown coffee, of course, is that the coffee plant isn't the only thing there, that it's not just from a monocultural coffee plantation, but comes from a plantation that still is creating wildlife habitat for birds and, of course, other animals as well. That's what this story about the turkey offers, is a chance to sort of think a little bit about how farming can actually preserve wilder landscapes as well.
Right. How farming can occur in an integrated ecosystem, essentially.
Exactly. And then there's this gendered component. One of the reasons why we lost this knowledge about the turkey is that it was male agricultural scientists in the early 20th century who thought women didn't know anything. And it was male wildlife biologists who thought that women didn't know anything. And so to think a little bit about how our knowledge is gendered in lots of different ways.
Right, particularly around food.
Yeah, we tend to think of that knowledge as coming from experiences only within the kitchen. But of course, women have been involved with the food process, also on the growing of plants and animals as well. That's not very often remembered.
Absolutely. As a historian, could you tell us about how the turkey came to take such a central role in the Thanksgiving meal?
Yeah, sure. You know, Thanksgiving as an American ritual does not really begin until the early 1800s, not 200 years before, as we might learn in grade school. Certainly there are things called Thanksgivings, but with a lowercase t. The Puritans in New England celebrated these things called fasts and thanksgivings, and to sort of make their relationship with God as it should be. So we don't actually get a Thanksgiving with a capital T to the 1820s and 1830s, and has everything to do with the anxieties about who Americans are as a people. And the Thanksgiving dinner is very similar to a London Christmas dinner. And the reason being is that the London Christmas dinner, which would often feature a turkey or a goose, was sort of a statement of who you were in terms of class. And in the United States, there was a concern that Americans weren't quite that. Americans often pointed, though, to the abundant nature they had outside their back door, that we're sort of nature's nation. The turkey presented an opportunity to say, look, we're where the turkey comes from. But then to eat it on Thanksgiving Day was also to say, look, we're cultured people as well, because we have the finest things that people have in Europe, too.
Wow. So there's a bit of ego involved with the gratitude.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I have one more question for you. What do you make of turkey slices and turkey hot dogs and turkey everything
right.
else?
Yeah, I think they're really interesting. I was actually just at the National Agricultural Library, which is the USDA's research library. I was doing some research there this summer for the National Turkey Federation. And it was really interesting to go through their archive and see their discussions about these products in the 1970s when they really kind of started to come on the market. They called them further processed turkey meats. By then, turkey had become so associated with Thanksgiving that it was very difficult to convince Americans that they should be eating turkey outside the Thanksgiving dinner. Trying to convince Americans to do that has been the great project of the National Turkey Federation. It shows just how much we identify turkey with Thanksgiving, that they spent decades and millions of dollars trying to disassociate the two.
It is very fascinating. It also makes me feel like so much in American culture is basically marketed to us by whatever trade organization is trying to get Americans to buy more of their stuff.
Gary Cross, who's at University of Michigan, he's a historian there. He's written that, you know, in the 20th century, Americans spent more money on advertising than they did on education.
Wow. It's almost to the point where I think advertising is becoming our form of education.
Right. I think we rely on advertising for lots and lots of information. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I've learned things that I had never known.
That was a really fun talking with you. Happy Thanksgiving, I guess.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy your meal. And
okay, I had a lot of fun. It was nice chatting.
Thank you. That was Dr. Neil Prendergast from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. He teaches history there.
And I'm wishing everyone a very meaningful and thoughtful Thanksgiving Day. Eat well, be grateful, and enjoy yourselves. I'm Dr. Jayshree Chander, creator of Neijing Now, a podcast about prioritizing well-being, on the web at neijingnow.org. Neijing Now is independent and entirely listener-supported. If you enjoyed the clip, please share it with your friends. Like us on Facebook and donate generously. Your support is essential to keeping Neijing Now alive.
It's Prendergast.
Okay, I got the R in the wrong place. Prendergast.
Correct.
All right. I'd like to know about your name. I love it. It's a great name. Tell me about it.
Okay. Well, as far as I know, it's an Irish name. And my family lore is that, you know, we came during the potato famine in the mid-1800s. The name supposedly is unchanged from the old country. There's various versions of our name floating about North America, and my dad claims that we have the original true Prendergast name.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that.